From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on Genesee Street in Rochester this past August. It was a late August night. A crowd was leaving a basketball game. A car rolls up. Gunfire sprays into the crowd. Three people were killed that night. Four others were wounded. And so here's a question that might seem strange at first, but it is important. Should we consider the Genesee Street shooting a mass shooting in official statistics? By one measure, the answer is yes. According to the FBI, the answer is now yes, but only as of 2013. And according to Mother Jones magazine, which has been researching mass shootings for 4 years, the answer is no. Take a look at San Bernardino 8 days ago. By now you know the story, the shooting that left 14 people dead, by any measure a mass shooting. On that same day, a group of people were inside a house in Savannah, Georgia. Police say a man pulled a gun, shot and killed a woman, shot and injured three more people. They believe not a random crime, potentially tied to drugs or other previous criminal activity. Should we categorize that crime in the same way that we do San Bernardino? Again, by one measure, shootingtracker.com. The answer is yes. According to the FBI and Mother Jones, the answer is no. And that's how we've arrived in December with such wildly different numbers being reported about mass shootings. According to shootingtracker.com, there have now been 355 mass shootings this year in this country, more than one every day. According to the FBI, there have been 22. According to Mother Jones, there have been 4. It matters because as we discuss public policy, we have to know exactly what we're trying to address and how. This hour, our guests will explain how these shootings are tracked and the implications going forward. Let me welcome my guest for the hour. Mark Concordia is here, a former FBI and police instructor, many years in law enforcement in many different ways, also an assistant professor of criminal justice. And Mark, we've had you many times here before, and I think your background in law enforcement is going to help us work through some very specific questions and some very broad questions, and thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also here is Rashad Altimer, PhD, who is a deputy director of the Center for Public Safety Initiatives at RIT. He's an associate professor in the Department of Criminal Justice there. And Rashad, it's nice to have you back here.
Thank you.
All right, well, we've had listeners say, we don't think this matters. What matters is every death matters. Every death is a tragedy. A gun death is a tragedy. A shooting death, no matter how what distinctions you put on it, is a tragedy. Why do we have to break it down this way? You've both said it, these discussions do matter. I want to start with Mark. Why does this matter?
Well, absolutely it matters, Evan. In terms of, I look at it from a law enforcement perspective, and I totally agree with you in that last statement, and I want to echo that behind every one of these data points, behind our very clinical discussion is a human tragedy. And I think we have to acknowledge that. You know, those victims, their families are not concerned with statistics. They just want justice and they want this to stop. So, but it is important, especially from a law enforcement perspective, because we're able then to understand how to more accurately respond to incidents that we would call, say, active shooter versus a mass shooting. So a lot of these studies that are coming out, specifically from governmental institutions or from law enforcement agencies, have particular scope and design. And that's where really the value is. And we have to understand a lot of these different numbers come from the definitions within those studies. But they're very important for law enforcement to try to understand how to respond, how to potentially prevent. So that's where the importance of this discussion and all these statistics really do matter.
Okay. Rashad, why does it matter to you?
Well, I think there are qualitative differences across different types of shootings. And these qualitative differences might require us to develop different public policy responses. So, for instance, it is true that all of these are tragedies, but if we lump everything together and we lose some of that nuance, then we may lose our ability to craft effective policies. And so I think we have to be willing to look at the nuance.
Okay. Now, I want to first explain one number and then have our guests explain some of the others. You've been hearing this number, 355 mass shootings in a number of different places, New York Times, Washington Post, etc. Mark Fulman is the national affairs editor at Mother Jones. He wrote a piece for the New York Times last week titled, "How Many Mass Shootings Are There Really?" And he helped explain where this 355 number comes from, and this is taken directly from his piece. Quote, "The statistics now being highlighted in the news come primarily from shootingtracker.com, a website built by members of a Reddit forum supporting gun control called Guns Are Cool. That site aggregates news stories about shooting incidents of any kind in which four or more people are reported to have been either injured or killed." So four or more either injured or killed. It's not clear why the Redditors use this broader criteria. The founder of the Shooting Tracker Project, who currently goes by the handle online Billy Speed, told Mark Fulman it was his choice, and he said, quote, 3 years ago I decided all by myself to change the United States definition of mass shooting. And so if you go to shootingtracker.com, that's the criteria. Four or more people shot in a single incident, injured or killed. And that's how we come up with 355 this year so far. So there's one. Then you've got the FBI numbers, and from what I'm reading, I'm going to ask our guests to expand on this. The FBI regarded a mass shooting for the much of the past decade, at least, as a single attack in which four or more victims were killed. But in 2013, a mandate from President Obama for further study of the problem lowered that threshold to three victims killed. Is that right, Mark?
Correct. Yes. And the FBI also uses a couple of other and it's one study that I'm actually really familiar with is the FBI active shooter study. And they expanded that definition to include individuals involved or in not in confined spaces, because there's a specific definition that comes out of the Investigative Assistance for Violent Crimes Act of 2012. And that's the act that you were referring to.
All right. So you've got three dead or more in a single shooting incident for the FBI to define it as a mass shooting right now. And Mother Jones research, which Mark Fulman has been doing for the past 4 years, they have settled on four or more dead in a single incident. And here is Mark Fulman's standard for why his magazine is tracking it that way. Quote, when we began compiling our database in 2012, we used that criteria of four or more killed in public attacks, but excluded mass murders that stemmed from robbery, gang violence, or domestic abuse in private homes. Our goal with this relatively narrow set of parameters was to better understand the seemingly indiscriminate attacks that have increased in recent years, whether in movie theaters, elementary schools, or office parks. So he's saying we don't want to catch any of those with what they consider to be a different kind of crime. Rashad, of these three metrics, is one better than another to you? What do you make of it?
I think all of them provide a different lens through which we can view these. And I don't think we should view one as either of them as better or worse. I think we should recognize that if we're looking at a complex phenomenon, we need to understand that from a multi-layered and complex approach. And so I think Mother Jones has done a great job, and some people might consider theirs the best, but even theirs has a tremendous amount of subjectivity. I mean, who determines what violence is senseless or not? You know, if a man goes into a dope house and robs those guys and shoots and kills all of them, would that not be considered senseless, right? So there is some subjectivity even in theirs. And the other problem with Mother Jones, even though it's probably one of the best, if not the best, is that they have changed the criteria over time, just like the FBI, which makes comparisons over time difficult, right? So people have to have a little bit of patience and understand that when we are collecting data, it's really a social process and we have to make decisions. And because we're just getting a handle on this phenomenon, it might be messy for a while before we get a consensus on these issues.
And Rashad, with Mother Jones's standard, there have been four mass shootings in this country this year. Planned Parenthood, the incident in Colorado, not included.
Absolutely.
Because of the number of people who died.
Yes.
Would you not consider that a mass shooting?
I absolutely would consider that a mass shooting. But you have to understand when you're dealing with data, you have to make these decisions. And sometimes for the sake of comparability, you have to be rigid. And you can always, no matter what cutoff point you choose, unless you go one, which would not make it a mass shooting, right? Three, four, five, or six, you're always going to have a horrific incident that's not going to be included. And that's just a problem when you're collecting any type of data.
Yeah, I think that's where it's incumbent on the media. Whatever metrics we're using, we have to make sure we're explaining them to our readers, to our listeners, because otherwise you get this lack of context and maybe you've got the wrong idea about how often people are engaging in these kind of events. Mark Concordia, thoughts on these varied, you know, metrics that we have out there?
Yeah, I just want to expand a little bit.
Yeah.
When we're talking about Planned Parenthood incidents like that, when we're talking about San Bernardino, I think that's what people are focusing on to a certain extent. There's another level of analysis going on about just the gun violence in America that has its legitimate place. But when we're trying to frame some of these discussions around San Bernardino or around Planned Parenthood, I think that's where it becomes a little bit obfuscated. So I think we need to understand one of the studies that I do recommend for this particular type of phenomenon is the FBI active shooter study. They did that. It was 13 years along with Texas State University. And that study doesn't have a number of people shot or killed. It has some defined parameters, However, the amount of killings or victims is not one of them. They break it down even further. They break it down to public places, more than one location, not part of another crime, resulting in a mass killing. People were targeted, that structure wasn't, and the shooters appear to be methodically searching for victims. What they don't include is self-defense, gang violence, drug-related violence or domestic violence. So that concept of active shooter, very different for law enforcement, because law enforcement has particular protocols and procedures and strategies to respond to and investigate and actually try to minimize the threat of an active shooter.
Okay, and so those 13 years found how many different shooting incidents?
160.
160. So just
active shooters.
So I think that comes out to about a dozen a year, about one a month. And so that's again from the FBI, as Mark explained the criteria there. Now, I see the phone's ringing. If you've got questions or comments on this, as we part of this does feel like a bit of a sterile clinical discussion. And we understand that. I think Mark and Irshad have made it clear that's not necessarily the goal. The goal is context, better understanding, but we do know that these are real cases and real people involved. If you want to weigh in on any angle of it, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Steve in Honey Eye Falls is first up. Go ahead, Steve.
It's Keith.
Keith. Hi, Keith.
How you doing? Hey, I think the term should be maybe tweaked a little bit. If I want to run into five people and kill them, it doesn't count as a mass shooting. I killed five people because the weapon of choice I had at the time was a car. But anytime there's a mass shooting, the intent is to kill them. So if I become deranged and go into a store and shoot eight people and don't kill any of them because I'm a crappy shot, it still should be considered a mass shooting, whether they died or not. So I think it should the phrase should be mass killing, okay, or attempted mass killing, then subdivide it into handguns, vehicles, bombs. Timothy McVeigh, I don't believe, shot anybody, but he ended up killing 100-plus people. I think sometimes, and then again, I see the issue with the how do you define it, and I think there should be a general consensus. For me, I think it should be three or more.
Keith, thanks for the phone call. Those are important points, and let me just say, again, that's why I think Mark Concordia was saying the FBI's 13-year look at these kind of events didn't just set a baseline of a number. It was more on circumstances, right?
Yeah, as I identified earlier, Those specific criteria for what makes an active shooter, which is very different than a barricaded hostage situation. It's very different from a mass shooting involving, say, a drive-by shooting or something of that nature, or another criminal event, a robbery that has gone bad. In those situations, when police arrive, generally the shooter is gone. Or is not trying to be caught, or is not trying to continue to engage. In these active shooting incidents, these are very different. The shooter will continue to engage, sometimes either take his own life or wait until his life is taken, and the threat continues. So very different, and that's really the essence of these studies. You have to understand what they're designed for. You have to read the study. You just can't skip to the findings. You have to read the methodology. You have to read the scope. And they'll be honest in all these studies. They'll say exactly what they're trying to do, where their data limitations are. This is all, but we tend, of course, not to do that. We tend just to focus on the numbers.
Yeah, one of our listeners on Twitter just wrote, I can't believe someone has to die for it to be considered a mass shooting. You know, my God. And Dr. Altimer, again, that's a sentiment we're hearing. I understand that point. Keith is making that point. I would urge everyone, if you want to read more about the impacts on shooting victims, the Washington Post did a story a couple days ago called A Survivor's Life. A 16-year-old girl who was shot at Umpqua Community College, how long ago is that? A month ago or two ago now, out in Oregon. She was 16. She was one of the survivors, because I think out there nine people died or so. So that's certainly considered a mass shooting. It was her fourth day of college of her life. And she was 16, going to school early. It tells her story. The shooter in that case stood over her after she had hidden under a desk and shot her in the back. And I don't mean to be graphic here, but I want you to read the story of what's gone on in her life since then. It shattered her pelvis. She survived it. The shooter basically articulated a chance for her to live because he saw she had not died. and she thought he was going to shoot one more time and kill her, and that's when the police arrived and the shooter ran out of the room and engaged them. She now needs help in many, many ways at home. Her mother, single mom, has left work to care for her. She is prone to anger, rage, all kinds of things, pain all the time. Her mom feels like that was the day that her old daughter died, and so this is a survivor. And if it just so happened that everybody who got shot at this community college had been like this 16-year-old girl, technically, by most metrics, it would not be considered a mass shooting. So that does seem to be a flaw, as Keith points out, as others point out. And that's just why we got to know what we're talking about. What do you think, Dr. Altimer?
Well, you know, when you read such a powerful story like that, it does give support to these measures that include all types of gun victimization if there are multiple victims. The challenge with that is that, you know, we will find ourselves with, you know, tremendous cases, you know, large numbers of cases. You have to understand from the researcher's perspective, they don't necessarily, if I'm going into the FBI data and I don't have these individual powerful stories, I just have numbers, I have to have a cutoff to make sense of it, right? So, and this is why my perspective is that, you know, Mark made a great point about the active shooter database. And I know for lay persons, it's hard to really understand the nuance. But people, are, if they really want to understand this, they're going to have to have a little patience and understand what these different measures actually assess. Mm-hmm. Because that story gives a tremendous amount of power to the whole idea that, hey, if it's four or more people shot or killed, we should measure it because there are real lives. But that most of those cases, if we took all the cases where people were shot four or more times and we looked at them, you know, with and across the board, a lot more would look like, for instance, gang shootings than they would Sandy Hook or San Bernardino.
Which is what we're talking about in the 355
absolutely.
Versus 22
and 4. And that's why it's important to recognize the tragedy of that victimization, but you will lose context from the research perspective. And this does not mean we don't value lives. It's just trying to put all these numbers and all this data in
context.
And
the research matters because if you're crafting policy, it's got to be specifically targeted.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That's kind
absolutely.
Of what we're saying. Okay.
Absolutely.
Mark?
Yeah, Dr. Altimer, because a great point. When your data becomes too broad, it loses its impact on informing policy and procedure. And that's what these reports and these studies are supposed to be doing. They're supposed to be specific enough that they can inform the executive policymakers on how to devise strategies to help prevent this from happening again and how to respond to it safely. Those are the designs of these types of studies. And absolutely, the problem also, and I think that Dr. Altimer would agree with me, while these numbers are staggering, and once again, one life is too many, one event is too many, this is still a micro phenomenon. It doesn't happen
absolutely.
All the time. So we don't have vast amounts of data to pull into. So we have to go 13 years. Now, what's the access to the information? You know, you're looking at news reports. Now, if it gets past, you know, it starts getting in the 70s and the 80s, you start to lose that context. Mm-hmm. And how good can you collect this data? But because your data sets are small, you really have to be targeted. And if you do 13 years, that's problematic in itself.
Mm-hmm. And just to add to that, one example, Mark Fox out of Northeastern, he has a data set where he just includes all homicides, all cases where there were four or more people killed, regardless of context. And to show how rare this is, I mean, it's still tragic, but he got 20 per year from 1976 to now, right? So these are rare events relative to overall gun violence in our society.
Yeah, and every single phone line is now lit up, and we're going to work through your questions and comments. A lot of emails coming in, you know, a couple of emails. So before I get to your phone calls, and if you're on the line, I promise we're going to spend the rest of the hour just working through your questions and comments with our guests. But I want to read two quick emails. One from a listener who says, Evan, it sounds like the whole point of this show is to make the claim that gun violence is not a problem. Ooh. No, not at all the point of the show. And then Ben writes, homicide by gun violence since 1980 has gone down by 50%. The only reason we're discussing this today is because it's politically expedient. Our country is very safe. So, look, we're getting all kinds of comments about this. And what that illustrates to me is that the trouble with statistics sometimes is that we try to use them when they are politically expedient for us. For example, if you are in favor of more gun control, you're probably more likely to post a story saying there have been 355 mass shootings. And there have been 355 incidents in this country this year, at least, probably more. in which multiple people were shot, sometimes in public settings, sometimes at work, sometimes in houses. So yes, I'm not making any claim. I'm saying, show me the data, give me the context, let's understand it as best we can as we go forward, because I think most people think there's something that has to change to make us safer. That doesn't mean I'm in favor of any one policy over another. And to Ben's point, you know, this is, I don't think people are discussing this just because it's politically expedient and our country is perfectly safe either. I think it's fair to discuss what safety means and what's happening out there. So, no. And again, for the people who would want to say, well, I'm scared. You know, Mark Fulman from Mother Jones said, here's why this matters. People are scared. You look at polls. Look at the way people are reacting to Paris and San Bernardino and Planned Parenthood. And you don't want people to succumb to bigotry or to fear unnecessarily. You want to give them context to empower them not to be overly scared. So if you're emailing saying, Evan, you've got an agenda on this, no, the agenda is, what is the data? That's why my guests are here, and they've both been here before. They've got plenty of training and backgrounds to help us understand this. Mark Concordia is a former FBI and police instructor, many years in law enforcement. And Mark, I never do your background justice. So tell the audience before I go to the phones a little bit more about your own bio. Go ahead.
Yeah, 22 years in law enforcement, pretty much worked every aspect from corrections to federal law enforcement. Most recently, my last assignment was with the Greece Police Department. However, I was assigned to the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force as a task force officer for my last 13 years, working counterterrorism in the community, working intended violence type of investigations, also involved in homicide investigations on the local and state level. And now I'm teaching at Roberts Wesleyan College in the Criminal Justice Department.
All right, teaching at Wesleyan now. That's his background. Dr. Rashad Altimer is the Deputy Director of the Center for Public Safety Initiatives at RIT, an Associate Professor in the Department of Criminal Justice. I was talking to Mark earlier this week about this, and Mark said you really ought to call Rashad and John Klofas and the people who have so much experience researching this, understanding it, contextualizing it. That's why they're here. So let's go through your phone calls, and let's start working through a lot of the questions that come up on the subject. Bob in Mendon. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi. I actually thought Keith was going to touch on this. It's kind of similar to what he was saying, but since it's considered mass shooting, I think everyone's intent is to harm or to kill. But just the definition alone, why don't they do it based on shots fired rather than victims?
Number of shots fired is what you're saying?
Correct, because a mass shooting to me just sounds like a lot of shots fired. I think whoever's doing that, the intent is to harm or to kill people. That's not always the outcome. But if you spray 50 bullets and you kill one person, to me that's a mass shooting.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Dr. Altimer, go ahead.
Well, if you just look from the perspective of prosecution, first of all, it's difficult to actually determine someone's intent without connecting it to the outcome. So for instance, basically across the board in our system, right, if someone shoots at someone but they miss, they're probably going to get prohibited with a use of a weapon. In that same incident, they shoot at that person and they hit them but they don't kill them, they're going to be charged with an assault. And if they shoot that person and they hit them, they're going to get caught with murder. So it's difficult to improve intent without looking directly at the outcome. The caller raises a wonderful point, and not discounting that point. When you're talking about having a system that has to deal with these issues and respond to these issues, the system cannot measure intent without cannot separate intent from outcomes.
Okay, Mark?
Yeah, and the specificity of the definitions really, really matter. Congress in 2015 released a report, and they define mass shooting as means multiple homicide incident in which four or more victims are murdered with firearms, not including the offenders, within one event and in one or more locations in close geographical proximity. Why does that matter? Because the FBI will also define multiple murders over a period of time very differently. Multiple murders over given, say, months becomes serial killing before it is now mass shooting or mass killing event. So to be specific on your definitions, and you just can't say the number of rounds that were fired, and once again, not to diminish the caller's question, because it's a very good one, is that once again, we're talking about impactful type of strategies that have to be narrowly defined.
Okay.
Also, if I could just add, it's a lot easier to count how many people who were hit than the number of rounds that were fired. And so while a measure like that would be a good proxy of intent, it also would probably be less precise than some of the indicators that we use now.
One of the things I'm finding out this hour is there's not a single perfect metric, and it's always better if whatever data we're using has the time and the resources to look, as the FBI did, incident to incident without just looking at it as a statistic on a sheet of paper. How many shots fired, how many people hit, how many people targeted, how many people died, how many people injured. Obviously, that matters. But, you know, if you look at Genesee Street this summer, to me, even if they're going after one person in general, when you've got a crowd of people coming out of a basketball game and there are bullets spread into that crowd, that and three people die and, you know, four more are injured, that's a mass shooting to me. That, to me, that counts. I understand Absolutely. The genesis mm-hmm. may be a dispute about something. I don't care if it's drugs or crime or whatever, but you're choosing a crowd of public people. That, you know, that to me should be a mass shooting, Mark.
Yeah, and once again, though, the FBI report was for active shooters, different. The congressional report was on mass shootings, and they would have included that in their definition because they talked about other felony mass shootings. So they had 317 mass shootings from 1999 to 2013. Now, of course, they had four or more victims, so Genesee Street was three, so they might not be. But your point is well taken that should be by all. But to have to narrow it down to three or four, I think the latest one with three victims, not including the shooter, is probably trending to be more the accurate interpretation.
Okay, and again, Mark, before I jump back to the phones, the difference between what happened at Genesee Street and an active shooter is an active shooter shooting and still on scene, engaging others, as opposed to what we might call a drive-by?
Yeah, the intent from the studies is very different. It's a somewhat sometimes a suicidal, homicidal incident where the individual is there, really doesn't have any intention of leaving the scene alive. They remain on scene, they remain active, they remain shooting, they're systematically, methodically looking for victims. And they doesn't mean they may stay right on that scene, they may go somewhere close geographically and continue the spree. That's still considered an active shooter. Very different response. You're talking about law enforcement, all hands on deck, multiple agencies coming in, bomb measures and SWAT teams being something similar to what happened in Christmas Eve 2012 at Webb's Webster.
In Webster, yeah, exactly. Okay, so if you're on the phone, Gary, Rob, Bonnie, Jenna, we're coming to you right after this short break as we continue our discussion about understanding gun-based violence in this country. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on the Next Connections, first hour, we talk to Rochester Police Chief Michael Simonelli. We'll talk about whether police officers feel they're having a hard time doing their jobs because everyone has a camera these days. Are they under more pressure? Then, second hour, upstate economic revitalization. What the state's decision means for Rochester and the Finger Lakes. Join us Friday.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Catholic Family Center, helping individuals and families overcome obstacles, including homelessness, addiction, and unemployment. 42 programs designed to help people of all religions, races, and income levels achieve independence with dignity. More at cfcrochester.org.
We have touched a lot of nerves with folks this hour as we talk about gun violence and how it's defined and what it means. You know, for example, Wendy emailing the program saying, I think that those who oppose gun control should go look at the bodies. I'm an old ER nurse from Philadelphia. I have seen many who were killed with guns. I think they should ship Congress to the shooting sites to view what it looks like. So that's a very emotional and strong comment from Wendy. Again, though, as I said, others have accused me of trying to minimize guns as an issue. Ben emailed the program to say people who want gun control are using stats as a political weapon and we're safer, much safer than we were in 1980. And both of our guests wanted to respond to that as well. So Mark Concordia?
Yeah, the public mass shootings are up. And significantly since 1970. Actually, Grant Dewey, he's a criminologist who studied mass shootings, public mass shootings, which is a difference than mass shootings again. He's been studying over 44 years worth of mass shootings. His study indicates that mass public shootings have increased in the 70s, the 80s, and continued to increase in the 90s and now in the 2000s.
Okay. And Dr. Altimer, back to 1980, you were saying what?
And my point was he is right that street crime and street gun violence has gone down, but it went down from historic levels. And so, for instance, if you compare gun violence, American gun violence, to other nations, which I've published some articles on that, we're not the leader of the pack, but we're still in that kind of upper, you know, quintile in terms of levels of just general violence. So violence, gun violence, you know, is still a problem in our society.
Okay. To the phones, Gary in Rochester. Go ahead, Gary.
Thanks, Evan. Thanks for having the program. And as you know, and so your guests, I also have a 30-year career in law enforcement and studied this issue. And I'm glad to hear, you know, your guests explain this, that part of the issue is we have to know what we want from what we're looking at, and that's why there are these differences. You know, as a former police officer, you know, the FBI is going to look at it from one perspective, a social scientist is going to look at it from another perspective. You know, somebody, the mass shooting on Genesee Street is one thing. A mass shooting by an ex-husband who walks into a house and kills his entire family is really something else. But what I wanted to touch on and hear your guest comment on is the congressional prohibition on the collection and dissemination of data from the centers that affect the Centers for Disease Control, the ATF, and the FBI. This is the only problem that affects such a large population where there's actually laws that prohibit the collection of data and evidence. And if we're going to have any kind of policy, you know, whichever way it goes, it should be based on evidence. And I just wondered if they could talk a little bit about that, on how as researchers in other areas, whether it's medical, social science or whatever, there's a plethora of data. But how this prohibition on the collection and dissemination of data affects the decisions we make. Thanks.
Thank you, Gary. Dr. Altimer, go ahead.
Well, I think it's a reflection of how polarizing this issue is. I mean, the fact is that it's so polarizing that people won't trust data from the best scientists at the best universities if it does not support their perspective. And so Congress has gone so far as to blocking the CDC from funding research and also blocking some of the abilities of federal law enforcement from tracking guns. And what this really has done is put a big blind spot in place of where we should be understanding this issue. We simply cannot answer questions because Congress will not let us ask questions. They won't fund the research, and they won't let law enforcement track certain things about guns.
Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I think Dr. Altimer hit it perfectly, and it, you know, you start to get into questions now of lobbyists and you know, what are the polarizing issues of Second Amendment rights versus gun control and gun safety. I think all of this adds to the lack of clarity when we're trying to really effectuate proactive, impactful strategies. And this is a problem that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, hearing Jake and some other listeners saying, you know, can't we get past politics? And, you know, even some relatively trivial federal funding overall, Jake said, seems to have been held up by politics. Can't we get past that? Try to get some good numbers here. So,
well, I think there's a general feeling, particularly amongst conservatives, that social scientists, and I will say that I think that social scientists are disproportionately liberal. And I think there's a, we've been having this discussion in the American Society of Criminology right now, that there's a big debate because there's a feeling that criminologists should reach out to their congresspersons to tell them, you know, fund this research because we don't have an agenda, because there are people in Congress who now are suspicious of the field of criminology in general. And that has supported passing laws to prevent providing us grant money. So it's very polarizing.
Yeah. Let me get back to the phones. And Rob in Penfield is next up. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah. I'd just like to ask the question of your panel about the disturbing trend I'm seeing in the news, including Wayne County and Ulster County, with sheriffs urging citizens who have permit to carry a concealed weapon to carry the weapon so that they can, you know, jump into the fray, and how chaotic the situation would be if police respond to an active shooter and there's other people with guns. It just sounds like it's a disaster in the making. I just want to hear their comments on that, and I can get that off the air.
Rob, thanks very much. And before I go to Mark Concordia, who has had, again, decades in law enforcement, I have heard so many different views, even from police officers, on this. A friend of mine is a very conservative person and a police officer in Ohio, and he tells me the last thing he wants are vigilante citizens jumping in, you know, in shootout situations, thinking that they're going to solve it. Whereas you see sheriffs, as Rob in Penfield is saying, who are urging people, if you've got a permit, carry. You know, be ready. So it's a wide range in law enforcement. You know, we're all one person, but what's your experience in this?
Well, I think this perception or this optic or this narrative is coming from the, you know, it comes from fact. And when you're looking at school shootings, you're looking at active shooters that by the time law enforcement arrives, it's somewhat 5 minutes and the event could be over already. So there's this concept of the only thing that stops a shooter like that is a good guy with a gun. However, from law enforcement, I'm not in favor of the citizenry arming themselves and engaging in these type of situations or even looking for like types of a vigilante, because those scenes are absolutely chaotic to begin with. And, you know, 20 years of law enforcement training on firearms, you know, all that goes sometimes out the way when you're in those type of situations. They have citizens in there, you know, who have been urged to arm themselves. Is a problematic type of narrative.
Okay, and what I don't see, we talk about the need for good data, right? I don't have an agenda. I just want to know what the data says. Here's the two questions I want to know. First of all, mass shootings, do they typically target what we call soft targets? That comes up a lot, and I understand if the answer is yes in some and indifferent in other. I don't know. I don't know what the information is. Number two, this notion that there's 300 million guns in this country, this notion of a good guy with a gun, how many times do we see the good guy with a gun stopping a mass shooting? I mean, have we ever?
Yeah, it has happened in the past. Yeah, it has
and
happened.
I'm not asking you cynically. I want to know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the numbers are as high as some people purport them to be. But, you know, when an SRO officer, a police officer with a gun, or a security, or even a principal that goes out and has access to a gun, it's going to change the channel of the shooter, all right? You're going to stop looking for victims, and you're going to start engaging what you see as a threat.
Which is what we saw at Umpqua Community College. When the police Correct. Showed up, he stopped shooting the people in the room, went out and engaged.
Yeah, and these active shooter incidents are occurring at soft targets. I mean, they're occurring at predominantly commercial and educational, commercial locations and educational facilities, unfortunately, where tend to be soft targets.
Okay. Dr. Altimer.
We don't have enough data on looking at people with guns responding to mass shooters. We do have some data on concealed carry in general, and there's some disagreement about, for instance, does having more people carry their concealed permit reduce crime? Most of the research says no, it doesn't have an effect. There's one famous study by John Lott that said yes, that's been cited, but most of the other research has not been able to replicate those findings. The second thing I want to point people's attention to is the New York Police Department. New York City Police Department publishes these hit ratio papers where they talk about in any kind of incident where New York's finest uses their weapon, mm-hmm. Discharges their gun, they're about one third of the time they hit their target. Okay, so here you have highly trained.
We're talking about officers.
Trained officers about one third of the time. In these kind of situations where they have to pull out their gun, they're hitting their target. Now, so I can't say for certain because I don't have the data, but I would be willing to wager that someone in the public would have a much lower hit ratio than police. And that kind of adds to the uncertainty of public vigilantes trying to stop active shooter incidents.
Yeah, and that's what I was referring to, the absolute physiological responses in a high-stress situation like that. And we train and train and train, and still you have those low hit ratios. And those, as you see on the news reports of these type of incidents, when the police arrive, they have no clue who the shooter is most times. And there's usually conflicting reports, 3 shooters, 2 shooters, 4 shooters. To have a civilian running around with a gun with no identification, the odds are that he's going to be confronted by law enforcement in a potentially lethal manner increase exponentially.
You know, people want to secure targets, secure New York City, secure street cafes, secure movie theaters. You want a bunch of people with concealed carry in a dark movie theater? You know, would Aurora, Colorado have been changed if I can't see how it would. But again, I'm open to the argument. I'm open to evidence. I just don't know. In some situations, as a free society, risk is going to be out there. You know, we're not going to lock down and put, you know, a body armored officer on every street corner, every street cafe, every movie theater. Or maybe we will. Maybe that's the future we're going to. I don't know.
Well, like Dr. Altmaier mentioned, that I don't think there's enough evidence for any of us to, you know, to come to a conclusion either way. The only thing that I was referring to earlier is that, you know, these active shooter incidents are generally over within 5 minutes, less than 5 minutes.
Yep.
And they generally end when police show up or the shooter takes his own life because he's confronted. That adds, I think, to some legitimacy to some of these claims. But once again, not enough evidence to suggest either way. And once again, I think that the cost-benefit analysis, the cost of having not trained individuals who are engaging in these type of, I guess, protective measures is a bit surprising and a bit, you know, problematic.
All right, Richie in Rochester wants to follow up on Robin Penfield. Go ahead, Richie.
Oh, hi, Evan. Good show.
Thanks.
Got great guests. Yeah, listen, about what some of these sheriffs within the state said that they would like more people packing guns. I'm just giving a scenario. Can you imagine a road rage incident with two drunk drivers or one drunk driver, and, you know, the carnage that could possibly, you know, happen from such a situation like that? You know, with two guys packing heat and they're maybe drinking and stuff like that. I mean, that could get pretty bad.
I think there's a potential for volatility. There's a good, if you're interested in this further, type in Stand Your Ground Tampa Bay Tribune. And Tampa Bay Tribune has a nice data set of all the Stand Your Ground cases in Florida since the law was passed. And they don't argue that there's more of these incidents, but they do argue that there's more ambiguity in trying to figure out exactly what happened when no one has to retreat. As the Castle Doctrine requires, everyone can stand their ground, and so you're having these kind of volatile incidents. So it may increase volatility, but it's very difficult to say.
All right, when it comes to what to do going forward about mass shooting events, two very different emails. We've seen a lot of different points of view this hour, which is good. I think this is an important kind of conversation. Karen just writes, I hate to be macabre, but she says, I think we need more mass stabbings and fewer mass shootings. Look what just happened in England. I think the point she's trying to make is, I think she's referring to the event in the London subway a few days ago. A man stabbed three people, one in the neck area, the other, I think all three survived. British police arrived and tasered him to the ground. He had a knife, did not have a gun, and he apparently had shouted, this is for Syria. And there were a number of people online pointing out, well, thank goodness this guy tried to do damage with a knife and not a gun. I know the point that Karen is making. What I also know is that we are a country unique in the history of this world. No country in the history of this world has ever had 300 plus million guns in it. So I don't know how we go from where we are now to where the streets of London are or England are, you know, without a mass confiscation. That's a word people don't like. Intellectually honest conversation says, if you want to talk about comparing us to other countries and you want us to be like that, you have to say the word. And I don't know that we're going there, but I understand her point.
I don't know that we can go there. I mean, one time I was listening to another AM channel that's not as civil as this one, and the host was talking about patriots, quote-unquote, shooting at ATF agents should they decide to take away Americans' Second Amendment rights and try to confiscate their guns. So just talking about it is very, I mean, I was shocked that he would even use that kind of language, and people were calling in and people were excited about it, you know? So, you know, it's we have a strong culture, and even if people were willing to give up their guns, if a small proportion did not, and you have 300 million in circulation, that's enough guns to kill a whole lot of people for a long time.
Yeah.
So we've got to think around that issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think going forward, the argument that says the bad people who want to get guns, they will get guns. They probably will in this country. We've got 300 million guns. We got to this point.
I do think there are some steps that we can take to reduce illegal transfer of guns. And I do think that Congress could empower our federal law enforcement.
Yeah, I hope no one hears my voice. I hope no one is thinking, oh, Evan thinks that we can do nothing to stop people who shouldn't. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is we are unique in the world with the amount of guns we have per capita population, and that is a reality that is going to be very difficult to contend with if you want to change anything. But certainly, I mean, there do appear to be plenty of ideas that would limit availability, yes?
I think we can have some incremental decreases that would empower federal law enforcement to look particularly at the illegal transfer of weapons. Now you could come back and say, well, a lot of these mass shootings were the guns were purchased legally, and I would agree. But I would just think gun violence in general, we could get a better handle if we did empower our federal law enforcement to deal with some of those illegal transfers. Right now, if Mayor Lovely Warren wants to go and just see what gun shop the majority of illegal guns in Rochester came from, the ATF can't give it to her, right? But if Mark wants to sell me a car, I can type in the VIN number and see where it's been sold. Where you bought it, if it's a Katrina car.
So
and
these are common
in,
sense and, things.
Yeah,
that
these are
could
common. There are some common sense things we can do. But keeping in mind that the mass shooting issue is still a needle in the haystack issue relative to the rest of our crime. So it may not eliminate all the mass shootings, but it could incrementally decrease some of our gun violence.
See, in the polarizing rhetoric on either side is what really is what we're seeing. We have sheriffs saying arm yourselves. You have other people saying take away all your guns. And those are the extreme ends of anything. The answer is balanced. The answer is somewhere in between. Believe me, law enforcement officer, own guns myself. But I don't want these guns to be on the street or the lethality of some of these guns because it directly affects did affect me and my colleagues. I mean, we're not in favor of conservative law enforcement, of proliferation of guns anywhere, and anybody can attain them any way and anyhow. The answer is somewhere in between, but once again, these are such polarizing issues. Same thing when you talk about the active shooter incidents, polarizing, you know, gun control, mental illness, okay? We have two really polarizing issues that no one can seem to come to an agreement on, and we have to get past that, and we have to start looking at preventative strategies, both on threat assessment and also legislation and other methods that can help balance this.
Sure, and, you know, sometimes we let the perfect be the enemy of the good here. You know, people point to West Webster, Christmas Eve a few years ago, as Mark mentioned, you know, William Spengler shooting at firefighters, killing two of them. And, you know, some people say, well, you know, that was a guy who was not allowed to buy a gun, straw purchase, he got it anyway. Okay, no one is saying you're going to stop every crime. No one is saying you're going to stop every mass shooting. But are there things that could make it harder? And if you make it harder, that's probably the first step.
Yes, absolutely.
Sure.
You know, I mean, so again, now let nobody hear me and my voice as saying there's nothing we can do. That's not at all the point. All I'm saying is when you compare us to Australia, you hear that a lot. Britain, you hear that a lot. You know, that would be a very, very hard thing for us to ever become Australia or Britain just because of the sheer number of guns we've gotten here. It's hard to go back. Let's go to Chris in Rochester. Go ahead, Chris.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, my name's Craig, but that's fine.
Hi, Craig.
You had asked how you get 350 million guns off the street, and the answer to me is fairly simple. You buy them. You take the amount of money this country spends collectively on law enforcement, gun control, corrections officers, the legal system, as well as criminal enforcement, take a slice of that money and buy them. Pay 10 times market rate for it and offer immunity to turn the guns in. And I'm willing to make a bet first thing will happen. People go to Walmart and clear the shelves because they're going to get 10 times the amount of money on them. But problem over. It's an oversimplistic solution, but simple tends to work.
Yeah, thank you, Chris, for that. You know, we talked about buyback programs. Australia's was a forced buyback. That was confiscation. Here, sometimes there's these buyback programs. We saw one in Rochester recently. Everything I read, Mark Concordia, and this is, please correct me if I'm wrong. I don't want to be wrong about this. I read a lot that when you have these voluntary buyback programs, it's often people in the suburbs, old weapons, want to get rid of them. You get a gift card or $100. It's not often the people you're trying to get the guns away from who are showing up saying, well, hey, I'll take that gift card or I'll take $100.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know enough about the actual type of weapons that were turned over, but I think there is that perception that a lot of these weapons are antique and you know, serve no purpose or can't fire. I know that through 22 years working in law enforcement, generally when an individual who's involved in criminal activity that involves weapons, they don't want to get rid of those weapons. Those weapons are hard to come by sometimes, and they keep guns. Whether they're used in shootings or whether they're passed around from one individual to another, they're not selling them back to the government. These guns are an integral part of their conspiracies and their violence.
Is there any evidence that suggests these buyback programs are effective?
No.
That was easy.
They're not effective. They don't reduce significantly the total amount of guns, nor do they reduce the amount of illegal guns on the street. They do make people feel good, and they do have some political, they do bring some political capital to politicians and officials, but there's no evidence that they work. And I just want to respond to what the caller said about buying the guns back. I don't think that Americans who view, many Americans view gun ownership as part of their American identity are going to, once they get wind of the fact, every time there's any evidence that the government's going to try to get guns, the reverse happens. People buy more guns, right, just in case. So, you know, I'll bury this one just in case they get the rest. I'll still have one, right? So I'm not convinced that even if they did four times market value, that will work.
Here's an email from John who writes, in our polarized political culture, so many people like to fit the facts around their opinions or make up the facts altogether. It is wonderful and refreshing to hear such a thoughtful, fact-based discussion about a contentious issue. Thank you for that. That's what this is all about. Thank you, John. And that's what we've tried to do this hour. And I want our guests to share about 30 seconds each, some final thoughts you want to leave the audience with as we think about what to do, and then mass shootings as we've been talking about here. Mark Concordia?
Sure. The best way to combat fear is to gain knowledge, okay? So when you look at these studies, look at these statistics, you have to go dive into the studies. You have to understand that these studies were not designed to create policy. They were designed to inform policymakers for better strategies and for practitioners. So take the time, read the studies in their entirety, and really understand. But once again, there is a story behind every data point, and we can't forget the human side of it.
Okay. Dr. Altimer.
And I would just add that I don't want anyone to go away from this conversation thinking that we can't do anything about these problems. But I do think we have to be realistic. And we sometimes an incremental approach is better than doing nothing at all. And right now I feel that things are so polarized that if everyone does not get every single thing their way, they're not going to give an inch, which prevents us from having real discussions and incremental decreases in these problems.
Really well said. Two wonderful guests this hour with their insight. Mark Concordia, thank you so much for taking the time to come in, and I hope to talk to you again soon on these and other matters.
Sure, thank you for having me.
And Dr. Arshad Altimer from RIT, the Deputy Director of their Center for Public Safety Initiatives. Thank you, Dr. Altimer. And again, I know we've got much more to talk about on these issues, so thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Evan.
A lot of calls this hour, a lot of emails and comments online. Try to get to as many as we can, and that's what we always do on this program, no matter sort of what side you're on or how you're viewing the evidence and the conversation. We hope you come in with an open mind, and we hope that you join the conversation next time if you want to join in here. Thanks to Val LaBanca, the engineer of Connections, and Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson, and thank you for listening to Member Supported Public Radio.